Hello, and welcome to the Duane Morris Money and Banking Law Podcast with Joe Sylvia, brought to you by the global law firm of Duane Morris. I'm your host, Joe Sylvia. I'm a former Federal Reserve lawyer who represents banks, fintechs, and other clients on M&A, payments, and regulatory matters at Duane Morris. I'm also a core member of our banking, fintech, and digital assets and blockchain practices. The goal of the Duane Morris Money and Banking Law Podcast is to inform and educate our clients and friends on both the fundamental concepts and structure of the banking ecosystem, as well as critical developments in the law and regulation of money and banking. On this episode, we're talking about commercial and industrial lending with Veronica Law, who is a special counsel at Duane Morris in our Fort Worth, Texas office. Welcome, Veronica. Thank you. So grateful for your time.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be here with you.
So first, can you do a little bit of an intro to yourself and your practice? Tell us where you are in terms of your practice areas and specialties and things that you enjoy doing.
Sure. So I've been practicing law for a little over 20 years now. And so all of that time has been dedicated to commercial real estate and banking issues. And so I generally call myself a commercial real estate and banking attorney. I do, however, have some specialties within that. So on the banking side, which is what we're talking about today, I have done a lot of representation of lenders putting together loan packages secured by commercial real estate. And these are mostly loans, I would say, anywhere from the $5 million to $15 million loans. So that's kind of my niche. And a lot of them are through the private bank arms of the lenders. So in those situations, as you probably know, when it comes to a private bank, those are the high net worth individual customers of the bank. And so that most of the underwriting goes to the financial wherewithal of the individual owner of the business.
Sure. That's great.
Yeah. Other specialties that I have is I do a lot of easement work. Have worked with some local utilities in securing like transmission line easements and easements for wind generated electricity and things like that. So I would say I'm an easement specialty, and then also do a lot of commercial condominium documentation work. So putting together mostly smaller size commercial condominium regimes for clients.
Great. That's fantastic. So let's jump in.
Okay.
You know, we're talking about commercial lending today. So what kinds of commercial properties are you seeing borrowers looking for loans on more recently? What's going on in the market?
Yeah, most recently, I have seen a lot of borrowers want to buy industrial warehouse and office properties. Several down in like the Houston area for one reason or another. And then also a lot of loans to remodel existing commercial properties. So not construction loans, but not necessarily like brand new improvements, but mostly, you know, a substantial update or a retrograde of an existing building. That's what I've been seeing the past probably year and a half, 2 years.
Really? Okay. So when you're going through these transactions, can you walk us through some of the basic loan documents that you're seeing? What kinds of interest rates are typical, loan-to-value ratios? What kinds of things are you seeing that are kind of at the market rate right now for this?
Sure. These packages that I put together, the typical documents would be a loan agreement. And, you know, that just outlines the relationship between the lender and the borrower, and it will include it will include details of the loan. If it's an advancing loan, kind of details around how often advances are made, when they're made, what they're for. It'll include representation and warranties that of course, the lender wants the borrower to make about the real property and about the borrower and its entity itself. Affirmative covenants and negative covenants, and I can get into more detail on those in a second. So loan agreement will document the relationship between the borrower and the lender and will be signed by both. And then, of course, there's a promissory note to evidence the extension of credit by the bank. And that is just signed by the borrower. what I've been seeing as far as interest rates charged in these notes is really they're mostly revolving around Wall Street Journal Prime, with a margin of anywhere from a quarter point to half a point, with floors of anywhere from 4 to 5.5%. So I really, at least the lenders that I've been representing, they're all using primarily the Wall Street Journal prime rate.
Gotcha. Okay. And what about typical loan to value ratios? What are you seeing in that area?
Anywhere from 75 to 85%. And again, the loan to value is that, as you probably know, but just for our listeners, is that that is the property value, minus 25% is usually, if we're doing a 75% loan to value ratio, is usually what the bank will put in. And so the bank will expect that the borrower will come up with the additional 25% to purchase, for example, the commercial real estate. So that's where I'm seeing the loan to value. And then to go back to the other documents, in addition to the loan agreement and the promissory note, of course, there's the deed of trust. And this is a document that puts the lien on the real estate for the benefit of the lender. And when the borrower is buying, tenant occupied properties, then of course we'll all also want the deed of trust to contain an assignment of leases and rents within it or as a separate document. But this will basically allow the borrower to collect the rents from the property until there's an event default, and then it gives the lender the right to go to the tenants and say, hey, you need to pay me now instead of paying your landlord. And then, of course, guarantee agreements, typically by the owners of the borrowing entities, authorizing resolutions, and then subordination and non-disturbance agreements would be typical as well.
Okay, that's great. So you mentioned some of the affirmative and negative covenants. What do those actually look like, if we could dive a little deeper for a minute?
Sure. So affirmative covenants would be, covenants that the borrower is representing it will do, such as, the borrower will maintain the commercial property, will carry property and casualty insurance on the property, and, maintain its books and records with respect to the property, inform the lender of any litigation that may arise for the borrower or for the commercial property itself. I'm seeing a lot that the lenders are wanting the borrowers to maintain their primary deposit accounts right there with the lender that's making the loan. Those would be typical affirmative covenants.
Okay. And are these loans ever guaranteed by third parties? Is that customary? Is that typical?
Yeah. Typically, most of the deals that I do, they're guaranteed by individuals primarily. So if an individual, as you probably know, like when the preferred method of purchasing commercial real estate would be to set up a single purpose entity, such as what I'm seeing most often is like a limited liability company to take title to the property. And then typically the owners or, the owner or owners of the limited liability company will be the ones that will be asked or required to provide typically full continuing unlimited guarantees of the indebtedness.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a couple of types of documents that I've heard of in the past, maybe our listeners may have heard, and I wonder if you could just explain a little bit of the basics around these. So for example, what's an SNDA?
Sure. An SNDA, that's an acronym, stands for Subordination and Non-Disturbance Agreement. So where this document comes in is that if the lender is loaning money on a piece of property that has a tenant on it, the lender, of course, will want to have the first lien, the superior lien on the real estate. So in the event it has to foreclose on it, it takes a property free and clear of any liens that are superior to it. So a subordination agreement will reverse the priority of the lien. So if the lender is loaning on a piece of property that has a tenant on it, then the tenant at this, you know, at the inception will have a lien. Its leasehold interest lien will be superior to the loan because it comes first in time. And so this subordination non-disturbance agreement reverses a priority of the loan. So the tenant will sign this agreement that says that it understands that the lender's deed of trust lien is superior to its leasehold interest. However, in that document, so that alone, a subordination agreement alone, the effect of it would be that if the lender were to foreclose, it would cut off the lease. Okay, it would cut off the, mm-hmm. the tenant's leasehold interest in the property. However, mm-hmm. the non-disturbance agreement, part of that agreement says, is a provision that the lender says, okay, so long as you tenant agree that our lien, the bank's lien, is first and superior to your leasehold interest lien, then we will agree that if we foreclose, and provided you are not in default under your lease, we will honor your lease. We will become your landlord and honor the lease terms and let you stay in the property as a tenant. So that's kind of the trade-off, the subordination and then the non-disturbance agreements.
Gotcha. Okay. And what I've heard the term landlord agreement. What is that and what's it meant for?
Sure. So a landlord agreement is another important document. So in a situation where a lender is loaning money, and typically this is all commercial real estate, but a lot of times the lender will want to take also a lien on furniture, fixtures, or equipment on the property. And some of the equipment could also be located in places other than, you know, the real estate that's is going to be purchased. And so in those situations where, for example, if some equipment is on a premises that's not the subject property, then the lender is going to want to have the landlord of that other premises agree that in the event that there's a default under the loan, that the lender will give, the landlord will give the lender access to the property to go collect the collateral. And also those types of landlord documents will allow the lender, reasonable times, et cetera, to go in and inspect the property. So a lender might want to go make sure that, you know, the for example, trailers or tractors, whatever, that are housed in a separate warehouse are actually there. It gives a right of inspection and then a right of access to go and collect the personal property that might also secure this loan.
Gotcha. Okay. Fascinating. Is there, with respect to landlord agreements, are they typically easy to obtain from landlords? Do they typically agree to those provisions? I mean, do they push back at all?
They are not easy to obtain. The landlord typically, you know, doesn't want to get involved in the tenant's, you know, financing arrangements. So I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of times the attorneys, when we get asked, you know, brought in on a deal for our clients, when they're buying, when we're representing, for example, a purchaser of real estate, it's really important for the real estate attorneys to get involved from the very beginning in negotiating terms of leases, so that if I'm representing a tenant in a lease, I will make sure that there is something in there that says that in the event, you know, my lender would like a landlord agreement, then you agree to, you know, provide one on reasonable terms. So, and that doesn't happen a whole lot. You know, a lot of that times that's not thought of when the lease is being negotiated. And so, yes, it is difficult a lot of times to get the landlord's agreement after the fact.
I would imagine, just the way that you were describing it. So that's fascinating. I want to pivot a little bit, because there's this concept idea for title insurance that I've heard about in the commercial space. And, you know, I'm familiar, and I think our listeners are probably familiar with the residential real estate space and use of title insurance. But what's the purpose of title insurance generally? And are there any nuances with respect to the commercial side of the house with title insurance?
Yes, I think, first of all, the biggest nuance with respect to title insurance, especially in Texas, I mean, I'm a Texas lawyer, practicing out of our out of Duane Morris's Fort Worth, Texas office. So Texas has its own set of rules around title insurance. So I think most other real estate attorneys and banking attorneys are used to seeing ALTA loan policies of title insurance. Mm-hmm. And that's not what is used in Texas. So what is used is our Texas forms. It's like it's almost like it's its own country. That's what it requires. But in any event, I mean, the concept of title insurance is the same throughout. I mean, it is this gets lost, I think, a lot of times on a lot of borrowers. But title insurance is basically a contract of indemnity. It is not a guarantee that title actually is vested in a purchaser. A title company, they typically have access to or own their own abstract plans where they can go in and research, all the real estate records. And so they do that. So they do their due diligence. So when they say that, yes, we are ensuring that when you buy this property, that it's titled in your name. Okay, but there could be mistakes made, and that happens occasionally. So if there is a mistake made and the borrower does not actually have a vested title or good title to the property and loses the property, then the title insurance will pay the borrower monetary damages. It does not get the property back for the borrower. It just pays damages. And so the same concept would be the same for a loan policy of title insurance, which what banking attorneys deal with. I mean, the lender will want to have a loan policy of title insurance, and this will often be paid for the borrower. But again, it's an indemnity. It will pay monetary damages suffered to a covered claim under the policy of title insurance. So again, it doesn't guarantee title. It does ensure the validity and priority of the lender's lien against loss from covered title defects. But if there is a defect that arises and title is actually vested in somebody else and the property is lost by the borrower, then the loan policy will step in and pay monetary damages to the lender, which is basically pay the loan off.
Interesting. Yeah, I think in some contexts, just as a kind of an individual consumer, I could see very easily how someone would think, okay, well, if I'm paying for the insurance, then that does guarantee me that this is my property now, right? And nobody's going to be able to take it away from me. When in fact, it's really just a monetary thing. So you may lose the property itself, even though you get your loan paid off and you're indemnified for that, but you actually could lose the property. So that's interesting and probably really important to be aware of. Are there specific endorsements that you typically recommend for these title policies?
Yes, I do. The ones that I most often recommend, as representing a lender in a deal, it would be endorsements. One is called a T19 endorsement, and then an access endorsement, and then survey coverage. And I can kind of put a little meat on the bones of each of those. So again, in Texas, Texas has its own title policy forms and doesn't use the ALTA title policy forms. But a T19, this is a most comprehensive coverage that a borrower and a lender can get on property when it is subject to maybe development for minerals in the mineral estate. So it's called a restrictions, encroachments, and mineral endorsement. And it provides express coverage for damage to improvements located on the land as a result of somebody exercising the right to use a surface for the development of minerals. It also provides protection against the losses due to the enforcement of any reverter rights contained in any restrictions or any existing violations of restrictive covenants because of damage sustained to existing buildings or an encroachment onto an easement by any of the improvements. So that's I think is probably the most expensive endorsement available in Texas for this type of coverage, and it's called the T19. So as you can see, that'd be pretty important to a borrower and a lender if they're lending on real estate That has been this where the surface has been severed from the mineral estate. In other words, the mineral estate is owned by somebody other than the borrower.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
So that's a good one. And then, of course, access. I mean, we would always want to make sure that the property has access to a public roadway, because if it doesn't, that, you know, significantly would decrease the value of the property. So you can get an endorsement where the title insurance will cover, basically say, yes, we know we've checked it out and there is access to a public road to get to this property. And then survey coverage is another big one that I always recommend to my clients, whether they're a borrower or a lender, when there are improvements on the property that is being purchased or that is being loaned upon. And survey coverage is basically coverage, an endorsement to the title policy that ensures that the survey is right, that the survey has identified, you know, any encroachments of the building onto another piece of property, or that all the or that there are no encroachments on any type of, you know, for example, pipeline easements, because pipeline easements, you can't build on top of them. And so you want to make sure that the survey is correct. So that's what survey coverage, the survey coverage endorsement provides.
Gotcha. Okay. And so when you're working with title companies on either the endorsements or placing the insurance, what's like the biggest challenge that you encounter?
You know, title companies, the premiums, at least here in Texas, they're all mandated. So title companies have to compete really on customer service, because they can only charge, you know, the promulgated amount for the title insurance policy. And so where I see title companies really either stand out or become ones I don't want to work with is, you know, non-response. It's basically revolves around customer service, in my opinion, just not being responsive to the requests of the attorneys, you know, taking too long to deliver a title commitment. You know, sometimes I will get a title commitment and it doesn't contain hyperlinks to the exception documents. And that's a big part of what I do. When I get a title commitment in the title policy, the commitment will have a lot of exceptions to coverage. And for example, for easements, if there are numerous easements on the property, I will want to go in and look at those easement documents to see if there's anything in there that might, you know, frustrate the purpose of why the property is being bought. I mean, if there's an easement that is a blanket easement that has all kinds of restrictions in it, that might be a deal killer. So when I get a title commitment and it doesn't have links to those exception documents, then that is frustrating to me as well, because I have to spend time to go back and ask them to please either send me all of the documents or put links in the title commitment so that I can easily access them and review them as part of my due diligence. But I think, you know, sometimes they're very busy people, and I know it's a high intense, you know, sort of environment to work at a title company. And so I think sometimes things get sent out without, you know, without doing the necessary diligence on their end. Another challenge is when the title company puts just, you know, like 10 or 12 people on the team. And so you don't really know who you should be corresponding with. And you're sending and getting emails from like 12 different people. it's kind of like, please let me off this email chain. I don't have anything to do with this conversation about this piece of it. So those are some of the frustrating items.
Okay. So maybe more of a bigger picture question, since I know we're getting low on time. I don't want to respect your time, but what makes a project where you're drafting loan documentation, going through the process, negotiating with the title companies and other agreements, what makes that project difficult generally, and what would help it go on a much smoother trajectory?
Sure. That's also a good question. I think the two big things when it becomes difficult, one would be to have inexperienced counsel for the borrowers, and then another would be unreasonable counsel for the borrower's attorneys. So, you know, I've been doing this type of work for over 20 years now, so I have a really good sense of you know, what's reasonable and not reasonable to ask as far as changes in the loan, you know, in the loan documents, things like that. And so when somebody that doesn't have that experience is brought into the picture, or maybe even put in charge to, you know, to represent the borrowers, let's say like a first year attorney, you know, that attorney doesn't really know what's standard and what's not standard. And you have these loan documents that are multiple pages, and I can just kind of, you know, a lot of times I can glance at them and I know that these provisions are standard, but an inexperienced attorney would probably start questioning them and start trying to strike a lot of those provisions. And so I can always tell when I'm dealing with, you know, an inexperienced attorney, because I will get a lot of those type of changes, unreasonable requests to remove provisions and documents. And then even with experienced attorneys, sometimes they will just ask for a lot of changes in the loan documents because they're thinking that, you know, they're going to ask for 10 changes, only expect to get two, but at least that's leverage. They feel like they're putting leverage on the bank's attorney, you know, like, well, hey, you got to give us something. But again, this, you know, this is frustrating to me because it takes up my time, which I don't mind giving my time, but the borrower is paying for my time. It's not the bank. So when the borrower has an unreasonable attorney that's, you know, quote unquote, wasting time, that only increases the fees that the borrower is going to pay. Right. The borrower is going to pay its own attorney, and then it's going to pay the bank's attorney.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So I really try to do my best to be efficient with my time, because for that fact, you know, the borrower's paying two attorneys.
Yeah. And it sounds like in many cases, they just don't have a lot of control over that, the amount of time that an attorney, especially an attorney they don't have any real contact with.
Right.
They don't have any control over the time that they're being spent, they're spending on the transaction. So that's interesting. So final question, and I'll let you go. Where, it's easy, so don't worry. Where can our audience find you if they have any questions or if they need your expertise?
Sure. I, of course, am on the Duane Morris website, and, you know, just look at the Duane Morris website, go to the Fort Worth office, and then my resume and bio and representative transactions are all outlined in my profile. I also am on LinkedIn, and I'm trying to be pretty active on LinkedIn. I will post occasionally, you know, tidbits of information for the real estate community that I think are just interesting to put out there and just to kind of connect with clients and with prospective clients. So you can look for me on LinkedIn under Veronica Law. And then my email address is vlaw@duanemorris.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. This is really helpful. It's been interesting for me. I'm sure that there are folks out there that have learned at least a little bit of something today, if not that we have a lot of great attorneys throughout the country here at Duane Morris. And so I appreciate your time, Veronica.
I appreciate you too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So for our audience, that's it for today. I know we had a really, really good conversation. I really enjoyed it. So if you have any questions from this or any of our other episodes, please reach out to me at jsilvia@duanemorris.com. Or you can reach out to any other of your favorite Duane Morris lawyers. Finally, be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening in. Stay tuned for new episodes coming again soon. Thanks again to Veronica, and everyone have a great day. Thank you.